Hello, humans. Welcome to the weekly Vine Down show, where we talk about, in a candid way, about all of the wacky aspects of our higher ed enrollment admissions world. Today, we're joined by Ashley Miller, who is the AVP for Enrollment Management at Old Dominion University in Virginia. I'm super excited that Ashley is here. She is truly a data-driven leader. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Emily. It's great to be here. Good afternoon, everyone.
Awesome. So if you don't know me, I'm Emily. I've spent the last 20 years working with about 500 colleges in CRM, student search, enrollment strategy. And if you don't know us at College Vine, we are like LinkedIn for high school students, where we are a professional recruiting network. Students join, create full professional and beautiful profiles in order to get recruited by colleges. Colleges send connection requests to these students, and students can send them to colleges. And when both parties say yes, a connection is formed. And once that connection is formed, it drops into the college's CRM as a super deep inquiry. And students can only connect with a limited number of colleges. And students have to be really thoughtful about how they use their connections. So if a student connects with you, it's a really high signal that they like want to be in a relationship with you, want to get recruited by you. We work with 2.2 million students on our network and hundreds of colleges. So we have tons of data that we observe about students and what they want, what they like, what they don't want, and what moves them forward in their enrollment journey. And that's really part of what we're going to talk about today is how students make decisions and how enrollment operations can be smarter about using the data that they have. And that is something that Ashley is a super expert on. And Ashley, as we always get started, we talk about three key lessons that you've learned in your career. So part of this, we'll talk about data. Part of this is we wanted to get you to get to know you as the leader. So I'm curious if you'll share with our audience three key lessons that you've learned in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think anytime I think about lessons in my career, I try to harken back to like all the advice that I've gotten from much smarter, more experienced people, because I find that, okay, if they've already been through this, they probably know something and I should listen to them. So I think one of the lessons that I learned is you have to take risks. You have to kind of do things that scare you every once in a while. Like I took this job. I lived in Indiana my whole life. I worked at Indiana institutions, and this is the first time that I've kind of ventured out like this, but this was the dream opportunity. And so it was a risk, you know, for me to say like, okay, let's move the family. Let's go. Let's do this. And it's paying off, you know, in dividends that I couldn't have even imagined. So I think you have to do that for yourself, you know, both in a personal sense and a professional sense as much as you can. And know that even if it doesn't work out, there's still like a good lesson to be learned there. So just take risks as much as you can, you know, do those things that scare you. I think the other lesson I learned was from a good friend of mine. I actually served on a board in Indianapolis. This would be a story for another day, but I was president of a place called the Antelope Club, which was a social club in Indianapolis.
Like,
yes.
Antelope?
Okay. Yeah. Like that antelope, like an Elks Lodge or, you know, something like that. And it was a great experience working on a not-for-profit board, because then you just get to work with so many different types of people from so many different backgrounds. And then I ended up being president of that board for a number of years. And one of the lessons I learned there is always count your votes before you go in the room. And that doesn't mean like in a manipulative way, but it means like you should be getting buy-in before you present something. You should be getting that collaboration. You should be getting that voice at the table. So that when you're trying to roll something out, you know which questions are going to come up. You know which concerns are going to come up versus, right, just present something cold the first time and hope everybody loves it. It's like, no, you're probably going to need to put this in front of people a few times so they can get used to it. It's part of change management too, which so many of us have went through in all aspects of higher education over the past few years. So I think that's another one that I remember that I keep with me. And then the third one may sound a little harsh, but again, it's a good piece of advice that I got from a good mentor of mine who's been with me actually my whole career. But he gave me some good advice and he said, you're not as important as you think you are. And I think that's good. That humbles you, you know, as a leader. And that also makes you realize I don't need to be making every single decision. I don't need to have all the ideas, you know, and that's why you hire great staff and you work with great teams, is because you lean on them for those instances. So don't feel like you have to do it all. That's a life lesson I'm still learning, but I think that's good to keep in mind that we're not as important as we think we are, despite titles or credentials. Like, it's all just a team effort at the end of the day.
True, but you're also referencing like sort of like the trope of like the maladaptive over functioning female enrollment leader, where like particularly we're like, no, we can do it. We can do it all, bring it all to me. Like I will control and gatekeep all of this work and do it all. And I think about the not as important as you think you are in terms of not only like that I don't have to own all the work, but also like if I feel embarrassed ever, I like to bring that up like to myself, like nobody's thinking about me as hard as I'm thinking about myself, because we can all get in that like doom spiral of like everybody's thinking about how crazy I am, and like really they're not.
What good
like Midwesty lessons that you're bringing, especially with the Antelope Lodge and the not being as important as you think you are, but like such good organizing thinking. So Ashley, when we did the pre-show, we talked a lot about like how you use data, and we talked about sort of how you got into this line of work, because you are not a lifer in the education space. So you bring this other experience from pharmaceuticals into your experience. And I'm curious, as a leader in enrollment, what's your headline about how you think about data in terms of how data and insights help you drive like behaviors and actions of your team? What's your like top level organization of how you think about and use data in your teams?
Yeah. No, I think from, you know, both working on the pharmaceutical side and now on the higher education side, I mean, I really think about it as it's a way to simplify the complex, because what we do is extremely complex at the end of the day. And I think that the more that you can use data to help tell that story in a way that others can understand, so they can tell two friends and they can tell two friends and so on, then it just makes sure that we're making the right decisions based on truly what we're doing for the students, or if that's not your audience, if it's alumni or whoever you're serving in the higher education space. I think that we're all just trying to make smarter decisions based on data. And I always say too that emotions are data points as well. So I think when we sometimes hear data, we think about like the hard numbers. And trust me, I'm a numbers person. I have a master's in data science. I still teach data science courses. It's like, I love a good number any day of the week, but there's meaning and emotion, and there's people behind those numbers, and they're complex. We're not rational individuals as much as we like to think, but so I think the more that you can tell the why and the context behind that, and again, tell that story based on those data points, then it's just going to make everybody smarter at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think there are the things that you can do to use data to tell stories in ways that they like land and feel credible and easy to understand. And I also think about data in terms of the way that good, clean use of data can help make decisions that otherwise would be really hard, really easy. I was talking to an enrollment leader this morning. We were talking about source conversion, like conversion through stages in the in the funnel, through like for different sources. And he was like, well, I can make this decision really easy because I can look at this data that says like this source converts at this percent, this source converts at this percent. So he's like, as I'm looking at this, I know like which vendors I need to fire, which vendors I need to buy more of, and like where I need to introduce. And it's just like a really easy way to make that decision. Like he, and it was funny, his whole posture as he was doing this, he was like, lean back and like, he's like, yeah, like this will be easy for me to do. And I'm like, yeah, like if you have that data, it makes the behavior very like clear. You don't have to agonize like over a feeling, which I think is like what you like, that tidiness of it is like, oh, it's going to go drive this behavior.
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right.
So Ashley, you recently published a paper for SEM Quarterly, which is a cool publication that Acro puts out. And it was a study you had done at another institution, but you were trying to gauge message effectiveness. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that paper. This is a really great article. If you haven't read it, folks out in the audience, but it sort of talks about like how the institution's reasons to believe. And again, it's not the Rod Stewart song. It's the things that feel like compelling as a marketing message. That the reasons to believe are particularly like are testable, right? And the things that we think they might be for an institution aren't always what they actually are. Can you tell us a little bit about that research?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had an opportunity to do this at a couple institutions. I'm actually really hopeful to do it here during my time at Old Dominion University. I've done it in pharma when I was there, but you know, some of the interesting things about just what we found out in that research is, you know, we have all these great messages in higher education. We talk about our student faculty ratios, our number of organizations, all the internships and career prep that you get. Like, we're all saying the same things because we all have those things.
Right.
And so, but it doesn't matter to everybody the same way. So I think what we did through that testing is we could really start to see, and especially at this institution that I was at, you know, they had a great message over frozen tuition, but, and that was like loud and proud and front and center. And we spoke that, you know, I'm pretty sure we had tattoos like at the end of the day that had that on there. And then you do the testing and you're like, yeah, that's still an important message, but like, there's all these other things that are going to get them here, depending on, you know, the background of that student, depending on if they're first generation or not, depending on in-state, out-of-state, depending on where they're at in the funnel, depending on what their parents are also interested in hearing. And so you start to get into the nuances of what that messaging story should be. It's like, yeah, that's a cool message and all, but really this is the thing that's going to drive their behavior, or this plus that is going to drive their behavior a little bit more so. And so it helps provide focus, because we all have our favorite message that we love, right? And that we think that, oh, this sums up our institution, this is what makes us great. And then only through testing do you realize, oh, well, maybe that's not the thing that we thought it was, or maybe that's not as important as what we thought it would be. So I think that there's just ways to tell that story based on data, and ways to maybe verify or validate some things that you know to be true. But now, again, you have the data that you can lean on, that or things that surprise you. And to me, that's where it gets exciting. Like when you find out something you didn't know before, or when you get something that's a little like, oh my gosh, I would have had no idea unless we did this research, then that's when it really comes to life. And I think makes our jobs easier when we can tell that story across campus too.
Yeah, for sure. That's something I learned really early on in my career, for the consultants I worked with out of college, who were some sort of like old bro enrollment consultants. And that's like the first thing that they told me, which was like, you will start to work across a bunch of different colleges and they will tell you the story of what makes this institution unique, and they will never be right. And as yeah. you hear this, yeah. like, this is our sort of little nugget of uniqueness. Like, you'll hear that across colleges. And like, again, colleges will say like, oh, well, the beautiful quad and the 11-to-1 faculty ratio. And it's like, everyone has that. You're not unique. Yes. And that's not what, like, that is not the meaning behind what keeps your community interested in you and your constituents, like, coming, enrolling, supporting over time. So that was a lesson I learned very early on, which was essentially like, you'll hear it. It will be claimed as true. It won't often be true. What do you think, yes. like, why do we as humans get attached to like our favorite thing, like our reason to believe, our chapter or our little nugget of uniqueness? Like yeah. qualitatively, how do we do that, do you think?
Well, I think we love a good story, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of it too. Like when you start to talk to those people across campus, they're like, well, my nephew who did this, or, you know, this one alumni who said that. And again, I don't want to discount those stories, because I think those stories can then lead to more investigation and more exploration and more, you have to have a curious mindset in this work yeah. or else you're not going to survive. You have to ask questions. But yeah, I think we get attached, you know, to a good story. And then, you know, again, these are people that we know, trust and love, like across the institution. So we want to take it as truth. And it's no knock against them or anybody else. But it's almost sometimes easier just to take that and run with it and say, oh, okay, that's what we're going to do, versus take that time, that energy, that money, that resources to really dig in deep, because then there's a lot of introspection that has to happen about who you are as an institution. And some of that's good. Painful. And yeah, and some that's bad.
Yeah.
And then you have to put that in front of yourself and deal with it.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is like, we're allowing like the stacked up meaning making of personal experiences to become like canon law. And you're saying like, that could be true for personal, like for individual people. And like the stories aren't wrong. Like that individual personal meaning making like isn't wrong. But like when you're talking about marketing, when you're talking about like enrollment strategy, especially when it's top of funnel message creation, like we're not dealing with like this guy's neighbor's nephew. Like we're dealing with like segments of people that we have to categorize by different data points. And it would be really hard to go into a room to say like, well, I don't think that reason to believe is right because I feel differently. But you're, to your point, like this is something that you can actually get down into the data and measure. Yeah. So, okay. So that sort of, this is the problem that like what we think makes us unique is not, we don't know that that works or not. And that's sort of my organizing question always, which is like, how will we know it's going to work? And with those messages, if, unless you test them, the answer is like, we don't know. We don't know why they work or how they're going to work or if there are other messages that would work better. So what did you do to test this? And this is where like audience, put your nerd hats on. Like we're going nerdy. I'm totally into it. Ashley, this is something Ashley does really well and teaches on. So like the professor is in. Talked about that. Man.
getting nerdy. I love it. Well, so a couple things. So, I mean, think about how we just test things in general, or everyone's taken a survey. So you kind of understand the mechanics of like rating scales, right? And you could love everything the same, right? I always go back to the ice cream example. So I'll use that for kind of our purposes here. But let's say that, you know, you're trying to compete with Baskin Robbins across the street. They have 31 great flavors. You can't carry 31 great flavors. You have this little tiny ice cream cart. So you want to pick like the top three. That's going to be able to get the most bang for your buck, the more customers to you. And I think with traditional kind of rating messages, you know, you could send them out and everyone could love all the ice cream because why not? Who doesn't love all the
ice cream? You could rate every ice cream. Like, and this is like literally how surveys work. You could be like ice cream 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you could rate all of them like a 3.
Right. Yeah. And then you're like, where does
zero
that
zero info.
Yeah. You're like, oh, I guess I can do anything then, right? Because they're all the same. So that's one situation. You know, even if you rank order them, then if you put chocolate first and maybe vanilla second and strawberry third, you're assuming there's like equidistant, you know, between those. And like, truthfully, you could really love chocolate. You're okay on vanilla, but like that strawberry, like, I'm only rating
if I had to
put in the list.
Yeah. Yep. Right. So like no, the ratings, like the rankings assume that like that they're in equidistant bands.
Yes.
Is what you're saying. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. And so, and no disrespect to strawberry in this, you know, instance. So for all the
strawberry. Screw you, strawberry. We don't want it.
So then what we did is what it's called a max diff. So maximum difference scaling. And so what you do is you give people choices because at the end of the day, that's what life is about. You have to make a choice. And
like
so
an either say, or choice, not like a across many things, right?
Right, right. So it's like, hey, here's, you know, a couple options. Which one would you pick as like your favorite? And which one would you pick as your least favorite? And you force people to kind of go through this exercise. And so they'll go through these different combination sets. And what's great about it is, if you and I were to take it at the same time, depending on our answers, those combination sets would change depending on how you answered and depending on how I answered. So it's not necessarily like the same thing for everybody. It's all dependent upon how you're answering the question. Mm-hmm. And so as you go through this exercise of, we'll stick with ice cream. You know, if you're saying, okay, chocolate, vanilla, I'm going to pick chocolate in this instance. But maybe the next time it's like, oh, chocolate and Rocky Road sounds pretty good. Oh, maybe the next one, it's Rocky Road and mint chocolate chip. And so it kind of keeps going through these combination sets until the algorithm on the back end has these value scores. And so the person taking the survey never sees this. They never give you a number. It's all done on the back end to say, hey, based on this person's behavior, based on what they told us, we're thinking this is going to be the score for this. This is going to be the score for that. And then again, it gives you that range of like what's most preferable to least preferable. And it also lets you know like which combination sets would give you like the most bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, if you put out that survey and you have chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, those are your top three. Okay, cool. But you could have just as many people who like chocolate as they do vanilla. So you're not going to get any new people to the ice cream cart in that instance. So you want to make sure that you're expanding your reach as much as possible.
Right.
And that's what that tool helps you to do is what's going to give me the most reach, what's going to be the most impactful. And then you can do it by different segments, different audience types, you know, you can go crazy with it to really get into those nuances of what you should be stocking your ice cream cart with. So that's the best example I can give. And I can talk about food all day long, but
I'm down.
That helps. explain.
Yeah. I mean, we like that's a really interesting difference between like either rating or ranking. And sometimes max diff is called like better worse analysis because it really forces yes. people as you present choices, like it really forces you to get a better scored order of like what messages really work. And you don't have to ask all of the combinations because you can know, right? Like you can know like, oh, like chocolate is the clear winner because we presented chocolate across all of these different choice sets and folks are getting into them. So yeah. is there like a right message at the right time component of max diff, or is there like a time horizon here or not?
No, I think there definitely is. I mean, I think when you are testing messages, I think that's a great point to keep in mind. Like you want to make sure you're testing messages that have longevity to them. I mean, if you're just testing things that you're kind of doing that are only going to be short lived, then I don't know if it's really, I mean, there's still benefit, you know, to testing those in some way, but like really when we talk about true message testing, like these are the things that your brand promise is delivering on, you know, and those things okay. should really be there for a while, right? Like those should
like
be
tagline value prop things, like tagline value prop yeah. that are like, not like, you know, like a seasonal temporary thing. This is like really what the brand speaks yeah. to. And okay, got it. Like sort of the ways you exactly. want to be out in public. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guarantee that everybody in the audience is like, yep, I totally want to do this. How do I go do this? Like, okay, bring it into real life. Cause like, I think everyone's down yeah. with the ice cream example. Like you don't have to fight on max diff. Like it seems like a really good way to test messages. How do you make it real? Like, what do you go out and get, do? What tools do you need or certifications do you need to be able yeah. to go do this on Earth?
Yeah, well, I mean, one, the hardest part actually of that whole process was whittling down the messages. Because again, like, I think if we all did that inventory at our institutions, I don't even know what the final count would be. But like, ideally...
You'd be like yeah. in a room covered in paper.
Yeah.
You'd be like in one of those tubes with like the... Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we're all there. So like, we're all there. But I think you have to then decide. I usually say like, don't test any more than 30 because one, like it's a taxing exercise for the respondent. And we are still talking about if you're talking to prospective students or current students, like, you know, if you're dealing with
you're
that
asking
audience,
them
like,
to do a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, if you can whittle it down to 30, one, that's going to be the hardest part. So do that first. And then, I mean, there's a couple different ways, like for what we did, I actually worked with a partner. They were called Sunseed Research. They were phenomenal. And I did that just because I didn't have the resources in house to do it on my own at the time. Sure, but yeah, now yeah. I think now that we have tools like Qualtrics and other things, like there are some max diff exercises that you can do and you can implement pretty easily. And as long as you, again, you're doing this in a objective way and that you're not spinning the data or making sure it's, you know, you're telling the story based on what you see, then I think there are instances where you can take it in-house with a team, with an analytics team, and really bring it to life. And also work very closely, too, with your marketing office, you know, and making sure that you're aligned on even how the messages are phrased. I think this has been a key learning for me too along the way. Like there was an instance where I tested two different messages and one had competitors listed and one didn't. Mm-hmm. And even just that simple addition of including like a competitive set in a message versus not changes the whole perception
for sure.
of what that message means. So you have to kind of think through those things too before you kind of get to the testing phase to say like, okay, are we all aligned? Are we all good with what we're going to put out there?
Right. Like to a fine point. Okay. So say you yeah. run this analysis, like you've got a lot of data, you've got a lot of feedback and you're like, okay, the reasons to believe that the president is like all in on is like tested horribly. Like we actually don't want to keep using this because the data suggests that this is no longer an effective message for us as a leader. And this is something that like good data scientists can do, right? Not just analyze the data. Like you're not an analyst, you are a scientist who can then like bring this back into a story. And as a leader in an institution, you also have to do it in a way that will feel like good, safe, and correct in your position. Like, how then do you go communicate surprises or what the data shows that's surprising or might rock a few boats? Like, any tips on how to make that palatable?
I would say have a couple shots of tequila. No.
yes. Okay. I'm down.
Yeah. No, I've been in that situation. And so I think, again, it goes a little bit to counting the votes before you get in the room.
Right.
If I'm hearkening back to that. So I think if there are opportunities where you can socialize that, you know, whether it's you have some advocates in the room, maybe it's your boss or a colleague or something, because it's hard to deliver bad news, you know, in that instance. And it's not even like in my mind, like, you know, it's data, it's research. So it's not good or bad. It just, it is. But for somebody who, again, has that emotional attachment to something or who even created it themselves, you know, they're going to have a different feeling or vibe to it. So I think the more that you can start to socialize it on a smaller level, get people to ask those questions, get people to prepare you for like what pushback you're going to get. And again, the more that you can just tell that story with data and have those other things in your pocket, then it'll make that, it may take several times. It may not just be a one and done thing. And I think that's important to keep in mind too, with our roles is like, I mean, think about it too, when we're messaging and marketing to students, like they have to hear it several times before, before it gets into their brain. And I think the same is true for our staff and partners across campus. Sometimes it just may take a couple times, a couple different ways, a couple different formats to really hit the message home. But I have found in all the instances where I've had to deliver maybe less than stellar news, people do come around. It just, some take longer than others. So you just have to have some patience too.
Such a good reminder that like people might need messages in different ways and also many different times. And I think to normalize that is really important. I think we get really nervous, particularly when we have to deliver bad news on a campus. So you don't want to hear yourself say it many times, but the more you can just like inhabit what you have to say with confidence, point to the data, you know, engage with your constituents with curiosity and kindness, and repeat that message to stand confident in the data is pretty awesome reminder. And Ashley, as we finish, as we close, we always do ask what you're excited about in the next 6 months. So share with us a couple of things that you're excited about in the chapter ahead. Now that we're living in this wacky world, we need good news.
Well, I just started my position here in October. And so I still feel like I'm experiencing a lot of my firsts here at Old Dominion University. And so, you know, going to basketball games, and we have our scholars event next week. We have our admitted students day on April 6th, which I have a phenomenal team, by the way. I have a phenomenal admissions and financial aid. And I know, and CRM staff, like, it's just like, I got so fortunate to get this role, but we just went through the admitted students day itinerary yesterday, and it's going to be so much fun. Like, I'm so excited for that, just to, and see students. Like, that's why we do what we do, or at least that's why I do what I do. And hopefully they'll come here, you know, even better. But I'm excited to kind of still experience a lot of my firsts, you know, here in this role. We are also, as an institution, we're merging with the Eastern Virginia Medical School. That's just down the street. Yeah. So super exciting. That's going to be official July 1st. There's been a lot of people involved in the background of making that all come to life. And so to have that, we're an R1 institution, and to have that now affiliation with this medical school, like, it's just going to create additional pathways for students that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's always exciting when we're meeting students where they are and providing more opportunities and doing it in a way that really benefits them and benefits the community too.
Yeah.
In terms of the health disparities and whatnot.
Have you been able to roll that out yet? Or do you have, are you just announcing this?
So, I mean, it's out, like, people know it's coming. So it's like, don't worry, I'm not sharing any secrets, but like July 1 will be like our first, like, we're together, and there's still going to be things that we have to figure out after that date. But, and so that's something I'm excited about. But then also what I'm really super excited about is I'm having a baby in May or April, depending on when she decides to arrive. But, you know, you mentioned kind of that overachieving female mentality. and so there's a couple things that I want to share, you know, because this is my third pregnancy. So my husband and I, we went through 5+ years of IVF to get to this point. Fun fact about Eastern Virginia Medical School in the city of Norfolk, that is actually where the first baby in the United States was born due to IVF. So it's like, it was
kind of good vibes.
I know, it was some sort of serendipity that like this all kind of worked out the way it is. But we did our embryo transfer 5 days before the interview for this job. And I don't know if anyone has been through IVF, but there's a lot of money and emotions and things that play there. And 1 in 6 couples will struggle with infertility. And so when we think about being in these leadership positions, and I think especially as women in higher education and leadership roles, right, you do want to take on everything. You do want to do it all. You want to make sure you show them like, well, I can do this job and this, that, and the other. And like going through this journey, there were things that I had to let go of along the way, or there were things I had to lean on my team for of like, hey, like I got this to do. Your guys are going to have to pick this up. And I think what's comforting, what I learned through that process, you know, and I share it so candidly because one, it's like, it's becoming more prevalent, I think, than it was before. But I share it so candidly because in all those instances where I piped up and said, hey, I need some help, yes, I've always gotten a yes. It's always been a yes. And it's always been with grace and with love and with care. And so it's like, you know, just if you need that help, you don't have to do it all. You're not as important as you think you are. So
I am, my like happy heart is bursting open with great like vibes and light and happiness that you said the quiet part out loud, because you have really impacted the audience. I think just to say like to any humans on earth, there's also like the human experience of those of us in our career who are parents or struggling to be parents or struggling being parents, that you've said a really important quiet thing out loud. So I deeply thank you for saying that. And thank you for being candid about your experience and for sharing that with the audience. We do have one question. Stephen asked, okay, I think this was when we were talking about like how you communicate with data and how you repeat on data. So the question is, does that mean you need additional research to back up the initial research that anticipates these questions from management? I'm curious to hear what you say to Stephen.
I would say, well, it depends on the question. So, I mean, thankfully, hopefully you can lean on that research and maybe you can just analyze it,
say it again,
a different way or segment it. You know, maybe it's just a matter of, oh, well, we need to really dig in on this segment, or, oh, did we parse this out, or what have you. Sometimes if you do kind of that large scale quant and then you are starting to get some of those questions, like then you can follow it up with a smaller qualitative study to then kind of get more again of the why behind it. But again, I haven't had that instance where it's like, you know what, this was great, but I'm going to need you to go
like do run it again. Yeah. Run it again, or run it deeper.
Run it again. Run those numbers. Can you crunch the numbers again?
Turn the handle.
Yeah. Cause you're going to get the same result. So I feel like, again, it just may be a way of, well, let's reframe this story, or let me tell you it a different way. And again, I've always gotten good feedback once we kind of sit down and really try to think about what is the question you're trying to answer? What's the problem you're trying to solve? I think that's top priority.
Well, and I think when you get questions about data too, it's really important to understand if like you've presented something like here's the data, here are the messages that work, and you get questions back. I think it's really helpful to understand the question behind the question that you're being asked.
Yes.
Like, and I think you could open up to say like, okay, I hear you asking this question. Can you tell me why you're asking? Like, do you feel like resistant to the results? Like, do these challenge you in some way? Like, do they just feel unbelievable? Does it just feel like half-baked? Like, to figure out why you're being asked will actually help direct what you're going to go do next, whether it's like turn the handle again or segment in some way, for sure, to understand like what's at stake and who's asking. Super helpful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, audience, for asking. Great. Well, Ashley, congratulations on your pregnancy. Congratulations on your baby girl. I'm so excited for you. And may she be like half as fierce and badass as you are. And the world is ready for another rock star. That is awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time. And audience, be well, take care. We'll see you next time.